The Destiny Foundation presents Rabbi Beryl Wein's Travels Through Jewish History. This, the 93rd tape in the series, is entitled Jacob, delivered in 1988. We hope you enjoy.
Regarding Yaakov Avinu, our father Jacob, and in honor of that occasion, Mr. and Mrs. Joel Sanders have sponsored the lecture in honor of Joel's father, Yaakov Sanders. Admeov Esrim Shono. Yaakov Avinu ends the period of the patriarchs, and he is the bridge between the era of Abraham and Isaac and the settlement, the beginning of the Jewish development in the land of Israel, and the fact that they now will leave Israel and go to Egypt, and it is in Egypt where the Jewish family becomes a nation, where the small family group expands and becomes now a large and great people. And that's what makes Yaakov's life such a critical one. Our rabbis say that Yaakov Avinu was the Bechir Shebovos. He was the chosen of all of the patriarchs. And Yaakov is the true father of the people of Israel to an extent that cannot be said regarding Avraham and Yitzchak. Avraham was the father of Yishmael as well. Yitzchak was the father of Esav. Yaakov is the father only of the Jewish people. And Yaakov is called Yisrael, which becomes the name of the Jewish people and the name of the Jewish homeland until today, and the name by which we identify ourselves. So Yaakov has that special quality to him. Yaakov also lived in a time of historic transition. You have to realize, as I've tried to point out before, the Avos did not live in a historic vacuum. They lived in a time when great events were occurring, or to them at least momentous events were occurring in the Middle East. And Avraham Avinu is at the time when the Hittites and the Canaanites, the Canaanites, come into the land of Israel, and they become the dominant empire. They were the dominant empire for almost 200 years. But by the end of the life of his son, of his grandson Yaakov, the empire of the Canaanites is beginning to decline. It will not fully decline for another 200 years until the Israelites, the Jews, put an end to it. But it no longer is on the ascendancy. And instead, you have the growing power of Egypt to the south, a power that will continue to develop until under Joseph it becomes the main empire and extends its influence over the entire Middle East. And because of that, certain conditions exist in the land of Israel that we find in the story of Yaakov. City-states develop. Instead of a central government, smaller sheikhs are able to control pieces of the country, such as Shechem and Hamor near the city of Nablus near Shechem, and the other chieftains whom we see. All of them, they controlled a very small amount of land and, relatively speaking, a small amount of people, but there was no strong central government during the time of Yaakov Avinu. The central government, Avimelech, the central government that we saw before of the Philistines, and the central government of Malkitzedek, who lived in Yerushalayim, and the central government of the Canaanites generally began to wane, and you had more of a laissez-faire, chaotic type of situation, which will be good for the development of the Jewish people, because the lack of a central government will give them a chance to be successful in the land. But it's an indication of the changing time, because Egypt is organizing while the rest of the Middle East is disorganizing. Egypt is becoming centralized and strong. Everybody else is becoming more diffuse and weak. It will therefore be only a question of time or of an event that will bring about the change in the balance of power in the Middle East. That change, as we'll discuss next time, is the great famine, which is presided over by Joseph, and that is the one event that serves to tilt all the economics and all the sociology of the Middle East in favor of Egypt against everyone else. From now on, for almost 250 years thereafter, Egypt remains the dominant power. And it won't be till the 14th century before the Common Era that Egypt will decline. Egypt itself, because of the exodus of the Jews from Egypt, goes into a decline from which it never really recovers. It continues to be a powerful empire, but it never again in its entire history has become the empire in the Middle East again. So that's the backdrop here. Another point that has to be made regarding the backdrop is that the countries to the north also are very diffused and disorganized. Aram, Babylonia, Mesopotamia, all of them also are not strong states. They are all decentralized. And because of the fact that they're decentralized, to a certain extent, they're destabilized as well. And that allows a person like Lovan, for instance, to rise to great power, even though he is, relatively speaking, powerless. He doesn't have the resources or the wherewithal, but he becomes a great and powerful sheikh simply because of the fact that nature abhors a vacuum. In that vacuum, whoever is there, whoever asserts himself, is able to proceed and to take power for himself. We're witnessing Senator Hart attempting to prove that axiom again. Nature abhors a vacuum. The question is whether it will abhor him more. Now, the rabbis teach us that Yaakov Avinu is not only a matter of biography, and it's not only a matter of history. Yaakov Avinu is really the prototype of the Jewish people. Kol ma she'ira le'Yaakov, ira le'bonav. Everything in the life of Yaakov is meant as an example, as a lesson as to what would happen in the life of the people of Israel, in the life of the Jewish people as a nation. And that's why the Chumash spends a great deal of time describing these events to us. And that's why the events take on a almost a portentous weight, tremendous influence, because of the fact that we're not talking what happened to an individual, but it is rather an indication of what will happen to an entire people, an entire civilization, in fact, to the entire world. And our rabbis say, therefore, that Ein Dor She'ein Bo K'Yaakov. There is no generation that does not have Jacob. And that if you want to read the blueprint, so to speak, for our generation and our times, it can be read in the life of Jacob. The only thing is, as is always true in Jewish matters, you need a discerning eye, and perhaps you need a very good mentor to be able to help you interpret it. But it's there. Now, let's review, if I may, certain highlights of the night of the life of Yaakov, and we see how historically these highlights are important and how they were cast in a certain light in order to give us an insight as to all later times of the Jewish people. Because as I mentioned to you, the rabbis especially, they always went back to the life of Yaakov to compare events and circumstances in their time to the events and circumstances in the life of Yaakov, and to see what inspiration or guidance could be derived from Yaakov's life. The first bitter lesson that we learn here, and I mentioned it to you last week when we discussed Isaac, Yitzchak, is that there's no guarantees regarding children. There are no guarantees whatsoever. And that Yitzchak and Rivka were capable of having a son Esau, just as they were capable of having a son Yaakov. And the Medrash tells us that for the first 13 years they both went to the same school. You should not think that that Yaakov went to a special school and Esav was cast out in public school, or Yaakov had a special Rebbe, or that's not true. The words of the Medrash are that all of the first 13 years of their life, they both went to the same school, and they both came home from the same school, and you couldn't tell one from the other. But when they grew to adolescence, Yaakov went to the house of learning, and Esav went other places. So, in effect, the Medrash is telling us the old environment, whether children are the traits of children are hereditary or they are learned, they're environmental. The Jewish tradition has always placed a great deal on heredity. And the genetics of the situation are that Esav had genes that were bad and that they couldn't overcome it, whereas Yaakov did not, for whatever reason. Their spiritual genetic makeup differed. Yaakov was an extremely handsome person. Our rabbis use him as the example for physical beauty. The Talmud tells us that there was a great and handsome person, Rabbi Yochanan, and he was so handsome that women would come to look at him because they wanted to have children that were in the in his guise. They felt that the prenatal influence, that if they saw him, then somehow it would their children would come out handsomer because of it. So the Talmud tells us that Rabbi Yochanan looked a little like Yaakov, and Yaakov looked a little like Odom Arishon, original man, which was the prototype for being handsome, created by God himself. And our rabbis tell us that on God's throne, so to speak, there are four faces on the throne: lion, the bull, the eagle, and man. However we want to interpret that, and I don't want to interpret it now, but however we want to understand that, but the face of man on the throne of God is the face of Yaakov. And the Medrash in fact says that in Yaakov's dream, when the angels went up and down, so the angels, you know, they went down and they saw his face, so they went up and they looked at his face in heaven. That was the up and down. Like, you know, aren't you familiar looking, right? I said it Friday night to Shalom Zohar, but no one got it. But last week someone came up to me in Toronto, and he said, I don't want to insult you, but aren't you Rabbi Wein? No, the Malachim here, you know, they looked familiar, so that's why they had to check. We just saw him upstairs, so they went downstairs, and then they went back upstairs because they wanted to see if it was the same person. So Yaakov Avinu had that quality within him of enormous beauty, physical beauty. He also was enormously strong, enormously powerful. We see that from the story at the well, where he rolls off the stone, something that takes all of the shepherds together to accomplish the same physical feat. The Chumash tells us that so that we should not make the mistake of thinking that, you know, well, he was studious and he went to the yeshiva because he was a skinny, puny runt. And Esav, who could be a linebacker, so he naturally went to, you know, he naturally played for Oklahoma. That was not the case. In terms of physical prowess, Yaakov was the equal of Esav. And we see that in the struggle with Esav, or with Esav's angels, it's a physical struggle. Yaakov wrestles him the entire evening. He wrestles him to a draw. He doesn't allow himself to be defeated, though. He does allow himself to be wounded, but not defeated. So Yaakov is a person of tremendous physical strength. And therefore, his ishtam yoshev aholim, his character of being a good, innocent, naive, holy person, is an acquired characteristic of his, not because he could not be the town bully if he wanted to be. Our rabbis say that Yaakov's main education came from Shem, the famous yeshiva of Shem Va'ever. So the Seder Olam says, with the book of Rabbi Yossi, the Tana says that Yaakov off and on was by Shem for 50 years and had the benefit of his education. And Yaakov, therefore, was not his prime. It's interesting because his prime teachers, apparently, according to the Medrash, are not his father or his grandfather, although both of them naturally had profound influence upon him. But to learn, to study, so that many times we know that. Many times it's not the parent that can do it. It's not the father that can do it. So he was by shame for 50 years. And the Medrash also says that he was Yaakov was with his grandfather Avram for the first 15 years of Yaakov's life. So it looks like it's 15 years by Avram and then 50 years by Shem, and then at the age of 67 is when the story starts. The education of Yaakov in the yeshiva Shem Va'ever was in ideas of philosophy and morality and ideas of Torah. The rabbis tell us that the Torah was studied before it was given. And by that they mean that the entire spiritual aspect of the Torah and all of the qualities that the Torah wanted human beings to have, so that required thought, it required analysis, it required concentration. The Jewish people have never believed that one can acquire spirituality by just saying, "Yes, sir, I believe." It's great to say that, and it's even greater to believe it, but that doesn't make it for you. There is a level of sophistication that is required in order to be a good Jew, quote unquote, that demands a certain intellectual effort. Not necessarily that one has to be Einstein or an intellectual genius, but there has to be an intellectual effort. That's why the rabbis made the Talmud so hard, so difficult. They could have written it in a much more simple fashion. But lefum tzara agra, the effort itself is many times the reward. The effort itself in the study of Judaism, so effort is required. And the school of shame was built upon that intellectual effort. And rabbis tell us that the years that Yaakov Avinu was by shame, he did not sleep in a bed. He put in days and nights, maximum effort to obtain whatever was involved. In fact, there's a medrash that says that that's why when he came on his trip and he lay down on the ground, he didn't feel that it was an uncomfortable bed for him, because he had been accustomed to such a Spartan existence and of falling asleep in his place. And in European yeshivas, a much later generation, and in our yeshivas also, both in Israel and here in the United States, there are young men that, you know, they stay up all night, they fall asleep over the text, right? They sleep 2 hours and they get up and they do it again. And that tremendous intellectual effort, that sacrifice is necessary in order to achieve this type of greatness. From Yaakov Avinu, we understand certain things, and certain things are hidden from us. One of the most difficult ideas that exists in Chazal is that Yaakov Avinu is the symbol of truth. Titein emes leYaakov chesed laAvraham. The Jewish tradition has assigned to our father Abraham, as I discussed with you before, the characteristic of chesed, of being a good person, charitable person. That's Avram Avinu. Okay. Yitzchak is the midah of din, of avoda, of service of God, of straight-laced justice, of uncompromising viewpoint, of self-sacrifice, right? Literally, going on the Akedah. Yaakov is the symbol of truth. The problem with that is that in the stories that are told in the Chumash, It is ironic that we always find Yaakov in a position where it's hard for us to see him as the symbol of truth. Whether it is in buying Esau's birthright, taking advantage of the fact that Esau just had to have that pizza, I'm convinced it was pizza, by the way. Not my interpretation of Adoshim. He just had to have it. So he has to have it. So, you know, Esav says, then what do I need it for? I'd give it away. Yaakov makes a shrewd bargain. Right? The birthright's not worth whatever he aimed to eat. Even jelly donuts. It's just, it's not worth it. And Yaakov takes advantage of the situation. Yaakov takes advantage of his father under his mother's instructions. And even though he does not utter a falsehood, he doesn't say that I am Esav. But he speaks with enough ambiguity to allow Yitzchak to be deceived if he wishes to be deceived. And Yitzchak wished to be deceived. Yitzchak, knowing that it's Yaakov, is willing to go along, but he's not willing to give it to Yaakov directly. He's only willing to give it to Yaakov under the guise of Yaakov being Esav. And then in his dealings with Lavan, even though Lavan is the master cheater, as Yaakov himself says, you have changed the contract with me 10 times. Lavan is the George Steinbrenner of his age. And because of that, Yaakov treats him that way also, right? Yaakov employs means to make sure that the sheep come out the way he wants them to come out. And Yaakov leaves him without giving him notice. And Yaakov does many things, none of which fit into our stereotype of the prime ethical person, the truthful person who never strays from the truth. Now, that's the difficulty. I am not going to deal with that difficulty because that's theology, not history. But I want you to know that this matter regarding Yaakov Avinu is discussed more than any other matter in the works of the commentators and in the works of Jewish philosophy. The Rambam has a whole long, almost a treatise on how we deal with these things. How do we deal with Yaakov Avinu? Because it is a difficult question, difficult thing to reconcile. But to us, Yaakov is the symbol of truth, of ultimate truth. Yaakov is also the symbol of ultimate charity, because Yaakov Avinu is the one that set the standard. V'chol asher titen li asera asrenu loch. Everything that you give me, God, he said, I'll give you back. Asera asrenu loch, 10% and 10%. So the 10% tithe and the 20% maximum, that's Yaakov Avinu. And he is the one who made it part of the regular part of civilization. Our rabbis tell us that until the time of Yaakov, there were very few charitable organizations in the world. The concept of Sdom was not limited to Sdom. By understanding this, we can truly appreciate how great our father Abraham was in instituting chesed in the world. Because it was, in our world, for instance, charity is an accepted rule of life. Whether or not people do it or not, whether or not government does it, but it's an accepted virtue. And therefore it's possible to raise millions of dollars for starving farmers or for people in Ethiopia or any legitimate human cause exists on philanthropy and on the efforts of other people to help others, which is a great thing. Olam chesed yibone. That's how the world is built, through this effort. But in the time of Avraham Avinu, that was not at all accepted. And in fact, the city of Sdom stood in opposition to that idea. The city of Sdom said, you know, what's mine is mine, what's yours is yours. You got a problem, don't bother me with your problems. You can't make it tough. Now, there are, it's a Lyndon LaRouche a little. There are such ideas in the world today also. But in the time of Avraham Avinu, those ideas were the paramount ideas. And so when his grandson Yaakov comes and establishes the idea of not only that you have to do something, but he tells you what the price is. You know, 10% of your income has to be given to charity. That's a minimum behavior of a human being, is that 10% of what he has he's willing to share with someone else. So that is a watershed. It's a milestone in human civilization. And that becomes part and parcel of the Jewish people. The Jewish people are, thank God, a philanthropic people. It's built in within us. So my Rebbe, Reb Mendel, Zecher Tzadik L'Vracha, Reb Mendel Kaplan, so he came from Poland. He understood Polish very well. So when he first came to America, he used to listen to the Polish Hour on the radio in Chicago. Chicago was a big Polish city. We had 1 million Poles in the town, most of which had telephone wires. But it was a very strongly ethnic Polish community, so they had a Polish program on 8-10 hours a day. So he used to listen because he wanted, you know, that's... So once he came, and he, I remember it like he's sitting here in front of me now. See, that was the day that the day after Ben Gurion came to Chicago in the early 1950s to launch the Israeli bond drive, Israel bond drive. So when Ben Gurion came, so they made the reception for him. It was then the Stevens Hotel. Now it's the Conrad Hilton Hotel in Chicago. Biggest hotel, and they had I think the price of admission then was $1,000 bond, and they had 7,000 or 8,000 Jews that came to buy bonds and to walk up to Ben-Gurion and shake his hand and buy bonds. So Reb Mendel went. He didn't buy the bond, but he went, and he came back the next day and he said you're the Jewish people. He said, there's a line around the room, three times around, a line waiting to give money. And they're happy and they're delighted. He said 2 weeks ago on the Polish radio, they made an appeal. He said they made $1,400 from Alec Polakin in Chicago. They called in $1,400. Because in the non-Jewish world, philanthropy is great. There's no question. We don't have a monopoly on philanthropy. But in the Jewish world, philanthropy occupies a different place. It's different. It's different not only in degree, it's different in kind. And that's an inheritance from our father Yaakov. That's a chol asher titen li aser asrenu loch. Whatever you give me, I will give you charity therefrom. I'll give. That's part of us. That's almost genetic with us. Our rabbis also tell us that Yaakov saw himself as the progenitor of the Jewish people, and that Yaakov was one of the two people whom God revealed. Apparently, the Medrash says that even to Moses it wasn't revealed when the Mashiach will come, when the end is. The two people are Yaakov and Daniel, both of whom were sworn to secrecy. God never allowed them to reveal it directly. But Yaakov saw himself in those terms, in terms of destiny. And therefore, the brothers are at a loss because they don't ever really know how much their father knows. And the Medrash tells us that on his deathbed, Yaakov said to them, Yodati b'ni Yodati, I know, my son, I know. So the Medrash says, what do you mean, I know? Not only I know which one is Menashe and which one is Ephraim, upon whose head I should put my right hand or left hand. I know that. I'm not senile yet. But Yodati b'ni Yodati says, I know all the stories. I know the story of Yosef, and I know the story of Yehuda. I know all the stories that you didn't tell me, I know. So there's a certain insight that belongs to parents anyway. Parents know about children even when the children don't tell them. But the more universal aspect of this is that he was a prophet of such greatness, of such note, that he knew. And even knowing, we see that knowing doesn't mean that you can control the situation. That's why many times not knowing is really better. A person can be blessed not knowing everything, especially in Muncie. People don't come and tell you, you don't have to know everything. By not knowing, you're better off, because knowing doesn't mean that you can do anything about it. Our rabbis did not spare even Yaakov, the great Yaakov, faults that they thought were present, and those faults are within the Jewish people till today. For instance, we have a debate in the rabbis, a debate which exists today. The debate is, what posture should we take vis-a-vis Esav? Vis-a-vis a wicked power that is out to destroy us. How should we handle it? So there's one medrash that says that because our father Yaakov bowed in front of Esav, and he gave him gifts, and he sweet-talked him, so he was punished, Yaakov. You know, Yaakov had the problem of Dino came because of that. He should have avoided, in other words, one of two things. Either slug Esav in the teeth, if you think he can do it. If you can't do it, then don't go to meet him. Make a wide berth, a wide circle. The medrash, the lashon of the medrash is lo hayatzorech lachnia atzmo lifnei arosho. He should not have lowered himself in front of Esav. Esav was going, so he should have let him go, right? He should have timed it, and that he didn't meet him. He should have avoided him. He went, and he bowed, and he gave him gifts and everything. Oh, you got to pay a price for that. So that's one philosophy, is it not, that we see today. I don't want to characterize the author of that philosophy, but that's a philosophy that exists today, and it's existed for a long time among the Jewish people. There are other midrashim that look just the other way, and that say that Yaakov should have been makariv Esav. He should have. In fact, there's one midrash that he should have even offered his daughter Dinah to Esav. Perhaps she would have been a positive influence. He could have saved his brother. He could have made Esav better. He should have worked on Esav harder. He should have dragged him to the yeshiva. Shouldn't have given up on him. And because he didn't, so that's why he had the trouble. So if you look at both midrashim, then you're damned if you do and damned if you don't, which is true in life, by the way. If you have a brother like Esav, you have no good choices. That's what the midrash is saying. Whatever you do is going to be wrong. And there are many situations in life that are forced upon us that way. And the Jewish people certainly have found themselves many times in life that whatever they do is wrong. I just am finishing reading Martin Gilbert's book on the Holocaust, which is a marvelous book. It's horrid to read, but it's a marvelous book. It's very rough reading, but it's harder reading than I imagined. The only book that I have found that really is that hard to read is Treblinka. But this is much harder to read than the general Holocaust readers. But anyway, there in the book he mentions that in the 1930s here in the United States there was a great debate whether to boycott Germany, not to boycott Germany, the Jews should take a stand, the Jews shouldn't take a stand. So in the hindsight of what we now know, it made no difference. It made absolutely no difference. But when you're living in the time that it's happening and the matter is so controversial, so there were very heated and vehement disagreements within the Jewish community. And we have the same problem regarding Russia today. What stand should we take regarding the Soviet Union? Shall we confront them or shall we play it low key? Shall we pressure them or shall we bribe them? How shall we treat them? You have the same problem regarding the Arabs, right? See, they're all, we dress them all as political problems, but when you see it in the Medrash, you see that it's a metaphysical problem. It's not just a political problem. What do you do with them? So that's in the life of Yaakov. So whatever Yaakov did with Esav, he was wrong. That's what the Medrash is saying. So one viewpoint, he's wrong because he was too strong. The other viewpoint is because he was wrong because he was too weak. Hard to know. The Gemara says something very, very strong also, that the Ribbono Shel Olam will say to the Jewish people, you know, why don't you return to Yaakov and hear the words that he has to say to you? So the Jewish people will say, Yaakov is not on our side. Because when God said to Yaakov, Anochi ered imcha mitzrayma, I'm going to go down in Egypt with you and I'll take you out, Yaakov should have prayed not to go to Egypt. He said, whoa, why did Yaakov agree that we should go to Egypt? So he's not truly our, what shall I say, our defender. He's not really on our side. He's a little on your side, God, right? He's not. We don't want to go by him. So what the Talmud is conveying to us is, again, that sense that in a time of trouble and disaster, whatever you do is wrong. There's always room for a taina. There's always room for a complaint against you. And that's why the life of our father Yaakov is so jagged to us. The pieces don't fit. It's not smooth. It always leaves us with a bad taste. All the incidents. The incident with Dina. I mean, what happened? The brothers killed Shechem and Hamor. They destroyed the city. So on one hand, that's terrific, right? It's the JDL in its wildest imagination, right? Realized. They got even. Achazona yases achaseinu. Are we going to allow them to treat us like that? On the other hand, Yaakov says to them, Hivashtem esruchi, you destroyed me here. What did you do here? And on his deathbed, he cannot bring himself to bless them. Klei chomos mechei raseyem, they are violent people. They're right and he's right. That's the problem of history. The problem of history is that it puts us into situations that there are no right answers. And unless one is sophisticated enough to realize it and to be able to live with it, then one is always terribly frustrated. That's why the story of Yaakov is the most difficult story of all of the others, because, again, the jagged edges are always there, you know? Oh, how come he favors Yosef over Yehuda? And over Reuven, over the rest of the brothers. On the other hand, if Yosef is the whole future of the Jewish people, if Yosef is the one that's got to make it. So however you bring up Yosef, you're bringing him up wrong. The rabbis highlight that. You know, he shouldn't have given him the extra shirt. He shouldn't have played favorites. On the other hand, if he wouldn't, the child's without a mother, and the child is exactly like the father, and the child is the genius of the family, and the righteous one of the family, and he's the one that's going to save them all. So I have to invest everything in him. So whatever you do, you're wrong. There are so many situations in the life of Yaakov that no matter what he does, he's wrong. And that's a clue. I told you I wasn't going to talk about it, but that's a clue to why Yaakov is emes. Because the MS here is the reality. The reality is that the pieces don't always fit. We would like them to fit, you know. We'd like to say, well, if you're consistent and you're this and that, it's all going to turn out perfect. But we know enough in life, we have enough experience, all of us, to realize sometimes it doesn't work that way. Sometimes you do everything right and it turns out wrong. So then you're faced with terrible, terrible questions. Yaakov leaves us with the questions, not with the answers. That's the emes. That's the truth. Yaakov is a man of dreams, of vision. which is again a not only a Jewish trait, it's a Jewish necessity. The great vision that he has, the great vision that he has of the ladder that stretches from earth to heaven, that's the vision that governs his entire life. Vine Hashem Nitzav Olav. He always sees that God is apparent to him. God is there. He has to justify his behavior in terms of that great ladder. Now, there are many times in life when every person has a dream, but there are many times in life when we discard our dreams. Some of us discard them for a moment. Some discard it for a period of time that's longer. Some people can discard it for 60 years, almost their entire life. And some people do discard it their entire life. But Yaakov was ever sensitive to the dream. He never lost hold of it. And that's really what governed his life. And that's Jewish national life also. But there are certain dreams that are apparent within the Jewish people. The response to those dreams, the way we deal with the dreams, the way we look at those dreams, that's really what all Jewish life is about. And there are detours and there are aberrations, and sometimes we forget about the dream, but the dream is always there. That's why Joseph, his son, has the dreams, as we'll discuss next time, and that becomes part and parcel of the Jewish people. And on this, there's one statement in the Zohar that, again, if the rabbis wouldn't say it, we couldn't bring ourselves to say it. When Yaakov makes a commitment to God, so he says, "Im yiyeh Elokim imodi," if God will really be with me, then I'm going to follow this dream. So the Zohar says, why did he say, "If God will be"? What are you talking about? You know, God is with you. You saw him in the dream. I mean, if Yaakov doesn't believe, then who believes? So the Zohar says, Chalom huzeh, it was only a dream. Sometimes a dream is true and sometimes a dream is a fantasy. I don't know. I don't know if my dream is true. Now, what the Zohar introduces us to here in this statement is the fact that the Jewish people and the Jew as an individual always has an element of doubt. Because to be certain means that you're God. It means that you're not human. So there always is an element of doubt, because doubt is necessary in order for belief to exist. If there is no doubt, that's not called belief. I believe, even though it could not be that way, I believe. And that element of doubt, the Zohar puts it into the mouth of our father Yaakov. Says, "Imi Elokim imodi." Maybe God will be with me. Maybe the dream is a dream. Maybe it's too much pickles. You know, maybe I ate the wrong thing. I don't know. You know, you see dreams. Who knows? So you have at one and the same time the ability of self-doubt, the ability to analyze the dream and say, "Well, maybe it isn't." And nevertheless, the tremendous perseverance and tenacity in maintaining the dream, even in the face of the self-doubt. And that's a remarkably sophisticated achievement. That's a Jewish achievement. That's not something that happens generally very easily. And that's why Yaakov Avinu is such a complex personality out of all of the Ovos. I think that's when I mentioned it to you 40 minutes ago, the rabbi said that Yaakov was Bechir Shebovos, the chosen one of the Ovos. It's because he's the most complex, the most paradoxical. And that's why he is the most identifiable. We see him, we identify with him more easily than we do with Yitzchak, and more easily than we do with Avraham. Because we have those feelings also. We know the problem. The problem is a real human problem. It's not something that can be lightly glossed over. Yaakov Avinu has family problems, which the Chumash points out to us. Problems with his wives, problem with his in-laws, problems with his children, also human. And family problems are the most difficult problems to deal with. And the pain that he suffers is the greatest pain that are from family problems, as it's true in life too. And he is unable to escape from the consequences of those problems. Two more important things have to be seen about the life of Yaakov. One has to do with one possible solution that he could have arrived at with Esav. There's a medrash that says that Yaakov and Esav made a concordat, they made an agreement. They had a summit meeting. And the summit meeting, they agreed that they would split both worlds. In other words, Esav would have half of this world and half of the next world, the world to come. And Yaakov also would have half of this world and half of the world to come. In other words, they would split the physical and spiritual aspects of dominance and the physical and spiritual aspects of wealth and of achievement in the world. And Esav agreed. Why did Esav agree? Because after all, he is still the son of Yitzchak. He's still the son of Rivka. Esav still has that within him. He brought it home for the Senate to ratify. He brought it home to his children, and they said, "Pa, you're crazy. The Lashon of the Medrash is, Kishehigid Esav l'anshe beiso kol ha'masa. I looked for this Medrash, I finally found it. I've been looking for it for weeks. I was going to use it in the sermon, but we'll let it go on the tapes now. They said, when Esav told him the agreement, Omrulo, they said to him, Lo yofe asiso, you didn't do a good thing, that's not a good deal. What did you sign here? You're buying futures from him. He's giving you half of the world to come. But you're giving him half of this world. This world is real. You're buying futures from him. You're paying good money now. You're giving him half of this world now for half of the world to come. So that's not a good deal. No businessman does that. Esav came back to Yaakov and he said, Ochi, my brother, Nikra Choze Shenase Beneinu. Let's tear up the agreement. You'll go back. Let's go back to the original deal. This world is mine and the next world is yours completely. And Yaakov said, what a good deal. Lo Moze Emtso Chein Beinecha, the Medrash says, quoting the Pasuk of Yaakov. How did such a favor that you're doing me? How am I worthy of such a favor that you let me off the hook? So there would be a viewpoint here to say that Esav was wiser, right? But the Medrash doesn't agree. And Jewish history doesn't agree either. Jewish history sees Esav as a tragic figure, just as it sees Western man as a tragic figure. It sees humanity generally as a tragic figure. Because if you only have this world, then you don't have either world. And if you have the world to come, then you have both worlds. That's the famous anecdote told about Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, that he visited his disciple, Rabbi Itzala, in Petersburg, in St. Petersburg. And in the Russian imperial capital, they were walking on the street, and a Russian nobleman rumbled by in his gold carriage with six white horses and the liveried footmen, etc. So Rabbi Itzel sighed and he said to his master, to Rabbi Yisrael, he said, Zetoch zayn elam hazeh. Look at this, look at the world that he has. His olam hazeh, this world. And Rabbi Yisrael responded, he said, No, my friend, Dr. Das is zayn elam haba. That he's riding in his eternity already. That's not his olam hazeh. That's his olam habo already. Sometimes I feel, somebody got a nameless person, got a very expensive, fancy car, you know, and he just sat in it. So when I saw that, so I said, you know, that's not his Olam Hazeh. That's his Olam HaBoy he's sitting in already. And that's how the Jewish people saw the world. They saw it in terms of the tragedy of man. The tragedy of man that he sold something important for a pot of lentils. So Esav does it twice. That's what the Medrash is telling us. The first time he sells it because he's hungry, right? Then he's young. The second time he's old already. And when he's old, he would like to buy half of it back. He realizes that he didn't make such a good deal. He wants half of it back. But then he can't convince his children. Then there are other people involved. When we're young and we're able to be free agents, so then we always choose to do the wrong thing. And when we're old and we're no longer able to be free agents, then we're not allowed to do what we know and what we want to do. Part of the irony of life. So that relationship between Yaakov and Esav is very important. And it gives us an insight, not just into Yaakov and Esav, but it gives us an insight just generally into the viewpoint of the matter of life. Second point has to be made regarding Yaakov is that the Chumash emphasizes to us Yaakov's contributions to the civilization and society that he lived in. Now, Avraham Avinu contributed, Yitzhak contributed, they dug wells, they made peace, they arbitrated, they were judges. The contribution of the Jewish people, Nivrechu b'chol kol mishpachoso adomo, that all the nations of the world are blessed through us. So that is not just a statement, and it's not just an accurate description, but it's a commandment. Through you shall the world be blessed. We are obligated to do things that are positive for society, to bless the world through us. And we see that with Yaakov Avinu. The rabbis say that Yaakov came to in front of the city of Shechem, so it says that he established the economy, set up the currency for them. Atbeya tikan lahem. Taught them how to use currencies. He taught them how to use money, which is a great lesson, great advance in civilization. One of the greatest contributions of the Chinese after monosodium glutamate is the ability to deal in paper money. Paper money was a Chinese invention. And we have just taken that idea and developed it, you know, checks and bonds and negotiable instruments, which really were an invention of the Rothschilds. And then now you have, you know, moneyless banking already, right? It's all done because what that does is it lifts money from the actuality of being a thing and it conceptualizes it and it's the abstract idea of value. Once you're able to make that leap, so then the economies can be enormously complex. It can all work. You can do all these sorts of things that we have today, such a complex world economy. But if every time you wanted to buy something, you have to bring silver dollars, so then you cannot run a sophisticated economy on that basis. There's no way to run it on that basis. So Yaakov Avinu is the inventor of that. Tikan le matbeya. He taught them the ideas of currency. And it says, Shvokim Tikan Lam, he made for them markets. He made a trade. Developed a strong mercantile ability to do these things, which is a Jewish trait. Jewish people throughout their history are famous, sometimes unfortunately infamous, but they're famous for their ability to be merchants, to develop a country economically. In the when I spoke to you about the development of Amsterdam and the Dutch East India Company, etc., that was all a Jewish invention, colonization. Many industries, trading industries, are beholden to Jewish merchants for their great development. So that's a tradition from our father Yaakov. He also built walls and built cities, invested, so to speak, in the society. He did not see himself as... there are people who see themselves as being a non-contributing member. They're allowed to have all the benefits, but they don't have to do anything. And because of that, therefore, you have very, very warped attitudes, if that's your attitude towards life. You don't have to contribute, you only expect to take. So then you're going to have a problem. I remember once in Miami Beach a man came into Miami Beach. We had people from all over the world. They would come down in the winter especially, and they'd come to shul, and he'd want to daven for the yomid. He wanted to lead the services. He had yortzeit. He was an ovel. So the rule in halacha is that if there's a member of the congregation that is in the same situation, so the member takes precedence over the non-member. And we had a very fine but aggressive gabbai in Miami Beach who would inform the person, if you're not a member, right, then you would try and sell him a membership on the spot. He was successful about 50% of the time. You say, you want to be a member, $300, we got a special winter membership, right? And then he'd let him go diving, right? And if he didn't catch on. So he had a guy once, and and the guy told him, no, he's not a member, he's not going to be a member, and he gave it to him, what's a shul for? The shul is for people to come in and daven, and what do you give me such a hard time for, etc. And he really made up such a ruckus. So the gabbai got angry, and they went at it a little too hot and heavy, and the gabbai was about to literally, physically throw him out of the base medrash, throw him out of the shul. So the guy said, oi, he says, that's what happened to me in the last place that I was in. That's an attitude, right? That's an attitude, right? That you can push it to the end, right? You get away with it, you don't have to contribute. You're entitled. You're entitled to it. And here Yaakov Avinu gave a very strong Jewish attitude that... You have to contribute to society, to general society as well. And that in the contribution to general society is found the greatness of the Jew. Finally, the last historical development is Yaakov dies in Egypt and he's brought back to be buried in the Maris HaMachpelah in the land of Israel. So that also in Jewish life and in Jewish history, and that is... The idea of a Jewish burial, number one. The idea of a burial in the Holy Land, number two. The idea of the respect to the dead. All of that is what Yaakov stresses. And that, again, is in complete opposition to the society that they lived in. They lived in a time when people cremated the dead. They lived in a time when, I'm talking about the common dead, the noblemen were able to have pyramids, the aristocrats, but the poor person got burned to death, just like in India today. Part of it is simply the shortage of space. It's much more economical. They spread the ashes over the river, but all of that stems from the problems that are involved. I mean, you go to Japan and everybody's got in his front room, a little urn, right? He's got his boba there. That can be unnerving. So, again, it's the introduction of radically new ideas to society. And those new ideas, which are the ideas of Torah, the ideas of Judaism, the ideas of God, which had been forgotten by man and revived by Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov and brought to man, these radical ideas will take hold. They take hold through the Jewish people, but they take hold in the rest of the world as well. And that the Chumash emphasizes those ideas to us. And we see that difficulty that Yosef has in explaining to Paro what he's doing here. He's bringing his father home. He looks at him, what in the world is going on here? Right, burn the old man and it's over. And because of that, the Chumash places the emphasis on it, so that we understand what is important, we understand what is significant, we understand what was the contribution of Yaakov that made him the Bechir Sheba Avos, the special one out of all of the Avos, out of the forefathers of Israel, our ancestors. Our rabbis tell us in the last almost ironic confrontation between Yaakov and Esav that Esav died the same day and he was buried, his head fell into the Maris HaMachpelah. That he came to confront the children of Yaakov, bringing Yaakov home, and he said, I'm not going to let him in the Maris HaMachpelah, I belong there. I'm the oldest, I want to lie next to my father. And they had a fight, and in the fight, one of the sons, Hushim, the son of Don, inadvertently killed Esav. He beheaded him. And his head rolled into the, it says, rolled over the grave of his father, Yitzchak. Yitzchak took him in his lap. So again, the imagery, right, of the father being reconciled to the son to the father, the tragedy of the two together. But by tradition, Esav's head is also buried in the Maris HaMachpelah, so that the brothers, so to speak, are together in death, different in death as they were different in life, but the twins are inexorably yoked together in this story of the Jewish people and the story of world civilization generally.
This concludes Lecture 93 on Jacob by Rabbi Beryl Wein. For information, please contact the Destiny Foundation at 1-800-499-WINE. That's 1-800-499-9346. We can also be reached by email at info@jewishdestiny.com. Shop online at www.rabbiwine.com. Due to copyright laws, we kindly request that there be no duplication of this lecture.